At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Your holidays are going well and you're planning to kick ass in 2020, and I just want to say I love you all and thank you so much for being so incredibly supportive of me and this podcast, and I owe so much of it to you, so thank you so much. All right, so this is the second part of a two-part episode of an incredible story and person I came across. If you haven't already, please go back and listen to last week's episode so this episode will make the most sense. And before I continue with the interview, I need to offer a trigger warning that the story covers some very sensitive topics and should not be listened to around children. And now, back to Matthew Hahn and the web of many different people's stories and lives that were changed the night he stole a safe from a Bay Area home. So that was the safe that would change your life. What was in the safe and what happened next?
Well, there's a little bit of a story to it, I guess. But so I brought the...
I think it's kind of like not a little bit of a story. I feel like it's a kind of a major story.
It's a major story. Yeah. It's a major story. I meant just like to the opening, the opening of the safe itself.
we drove 6 hours just to interview you about this story. Okay. So okay. It's a major story.
It's a major story. Major story. So yeah, you know, I went home with this guy. We went to my place, and it was still the middle of the night, and so I didn't think it was... I mean, I don't know how to open a safe, right? Like, I'm sure there's safe crackers out there. I'm not one of them.
Yeah.
So, like, the only thing, like, I knew how to do was to, like, cut and gouge and, like, make it...
That's probably... who would know how to open a safe?
Yeah, I don't know how to open a safe. So, like...
I think that's only in movies, heist movies. They are like, oh, let me just, like, fake the... Yeah.
Right. Or, like, a little, like, bomb that you put on the door that pops it open or whatever. Like, no, I didn't have any of that. So, like, I knew whatever I did, I was going to be making a lot of noise. So, I'm like, I can't do this in the middle of the night in my, like, quiet suburban neighborhood. They all know I'm dope fiend already, but there's no need to give them, you know, more evidence. Let's put it that way. Or much less have them call the cops.
Yeah.
So, you know, I basically told the guy, I'm like, look, I'm going to wait till like 8 a.m. to cut this thing open. He's like, well, I'm not going to stick around for that. Like, I got to get back to my girlfriend or whatever. I'm like, okay. He's like, do you want to come over at 8 o'clock? He's like, maybe I'll come over at 8 o'clock. Or if you just decide to open it, just let me know what's in it.
Mm-hmm. I love that there's like a kind of a camaraderie with stealing. Like, okay, so we check out what we got later. Like,
yeah, but like, honestly, like I was a little sly here because like, there's a part of me that when he said, yeah, I'll come back at 8, you know, or I mean, I might not come back at 8. There's a part of me that thought, well, if there's a bunch of money in it, like, I don't have to tell him how much there was. Like, I'm just being honest, right? Not to him. Like, none of this is honest. So let's be clear. None of this is honest. But, like, I'm being honest to you. Like, there's a part of me that thought, like, maybe I could keep a little extra for my trouble.
Yeah. yeah, I mean, you were the one breaking it open.
Exactly. So 8 o'clock came around, and I went at it with, like, a die grinder and, like, a giant crowbar that was, like, bigger than me, and... dropped it on the concrete a couple of times, you know, whatever, to get things, you know, rolling around. And eventually I remember, like, I managed to pry open like a corner of the door, like big enough to like reach my arm in. And so like, I think the first thing I grabbed, I mean, it was soft, you know, and I reached in and it was like soft and it was like kind of cold and it was squishy. And obviously my brain is like, this doesn't feel like a stack of money.
Like, so but you can't see what's in there because you've only gotten a certain part.
Because I only opened up like a small...
Okay, so it's like a small hole. Okay, got it.
I basically pried the corner of the door open. Mm-hmm. So I pull this thing out and it ends up, it's a diaper. And it's a soiled diaper at that, you know? And so I reach back in the safe and there's another soft thing and it's kind of heavy and I pull it out. It's another soiled diaper. And I don't remember how many of these things I pulled out. It might've been 4 or 5. I don't know. And I do remember pulling out like a pack or a handful of like regular, or I'm not going to say regular, unused diapers. Mm-hmm. And these are kids' diapers, by the way. These aren't like Depends or whatever. I do remember opening up one of the diapers because they were heavy. So I thought like maybe there's like they're hiding jewelry or something breakable in the diaper. But that wasn't the case. They were like soiled diapers.
Yeah.
So I'm like, this is kind of creepy.
Yeah,
but I really didn't like make any like assumptions or leaps beyond that. I'm like, that's just weird, you know? But I didn't think anything else beyond it. And so I kept kind of digging around in there, and I pulled out some paperwork and like some photographs and like a bank card. The paperwork was actually adoption paperwork for the whoever owned the safe. And then there was like a memory card. And like, I'm kind of into photography today, but I was also into it back then. Like, I recognized the memory card as like one of the ones that I used in like my own camera. And mm-hmm. I happened to have like, back in the day, we had these things called computer towers, mm-hmm. you know, that you hooked your terminal up to, you know, or your monitor. And so like, I had
I'm old enough to remember those.
So you remember those. Yeah. Well, like, I had like this like awesome computer tower, probably rare at the time, that mm-hmm. had like slots for all these different SD cards. Mm-hmm. And so I remember I put that memory card into the computer tower, and you know, the photographs, and they don't really do it the same way anymore. But back then, you kind of, whenever something was getting read by the computer, like a window would pop open, and then everything that was on that thing would like kind of like stream across the screen as thumbnails.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like a cascade of like miniature versions of the photo.
Okay.
And maybe the computers still do that today, but mine doesn't. My Mac doesn't do it that way.
Yeah.
Anyways, like, so I remember seeing all these little thumbnails, and I saw like a couple that actually just made me think that like, oh, it was like somebody's homemade porn.
Yeah. So the just like the first photo you saw was,
well, they were teeny. Uh-huh. So like I saw them all at once.
I understand. Right? Okay. I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying when they're small. I thought they were like when they're like a gallery. Like
I know what you're talking about. Yeah. No, it wasn't that style. Okay. It was like all like little teeny, excuse me, all little teeny ones. Mm-hmm. And, so yeah, like I clicked on the first one I thought was like the homemade porn.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a part of me that's like, oh, you don't run into this every day, right? Yeah. And I remember looking at the photo, and there was just something wrong about it. And I don't need to describe like in crazy detail what this photo was, but it was a close up. You know, it was a close up of the sex act that was happening. And I remember thinking there was just something weird about it, but I couldn't quite put my finger on it. And so I clicked on the next one, or I scrolled, or however I did it. And the next photograph, or a couple photographs later, I don't remember. That's when it became obvious what I was looking at.
And it was...
It was a child that, you know, I thought at the time maybe 3 years old. It was a girl. And I found out later she was actually like 18 months old.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a man in there, and he was naked, and it was clear that it was a sex act that's happening. And so what I was looking at was, you know, somebody, it wasn't just like child porn, it was like child rape.
Yeah.
And that's what, there was a number more photos like that.
Yeah.
On the memory card, in addition to some other kind of like random photos.
Yeah.
And so like I knew I had to do something about it. But that's kind of easier said than done, right? Like mm-hmm. when you're like a three striker.
Yeah,
like,
you were about ready to.
Yeah, you run into this at like a yard sale. You're like, you buy a box of like camera equipment at a yard sale. You come home, you pop this in, you're like, oh.
Holy shit,
let me call the cops. Let me tell you the yard sale I bought it at. Like,
you were faced with a.
This was a little different.
A decision.
Yeah, so it wasn't going to be. I couldn't just walk into. I mean, I could have, but I didn't think it was a smart decision. It was to walk into the local police department and go like, I've been robbing all the rich folks around here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, please forgive me because I found this. Like, I just didn't see that as a viable option, but I needed to do something. So I called the guy. Or did I page him? No, I called him. It wasn't pager. It wasn't
the guy that I'd stolen
the safe with. And I said, hey, man, you need to come over. He's like, what was in there? I'm like, why don't you come over?
Yeah.
We got to talk about what's in the safe. And he showed up a couple hours later and, and there was like a gun in there too. And so like I showed him the gun, and you know, like the paperwork and this and that. And he's like, that's it. I'm like, that's all that was in there, man. Except for this. And so I put the memory card in the computer, and he looked at the photos and he's like, I don't want anything to do with these.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, okay, well, but so we got to do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like I said, like, I don't want anything to do with it. And I said something to him, something along the lines to him about, I don't want anything to do with it either.
Yeah, like you're not like wanting to, but you can't.
But we have them now.
Yeah, like, and you
these
can't.
These are in our possession.
Yeah, what are you just going to know that this little, like, it's clearly the guy with the safe is trying to hide that he's doing this to this child. You have to let the parents know, or something has to happen.
Yeah, and I feel like when he said, you know, like, this is me hindsight reasoning, but mm-hmm. I feel like the first time he said, I don't want anything to do with it, it was actually more denial. It was mm-hmm. like, I want to pretend like this never happened.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the second time he said it was in response to me saying, basically saying I wanted to turn them in.
Yeah.
And so, like, it was the first time he's like, oh my gosh, I don't.
Yeah.
And the second time was like, well, if you're going to do that, don't include me in the whole process.
Well, I think probably too, seeing something like that is one of the scariest things you can see. And you probably are just like, he probably was in denial.
It was actually unbelievable.
Yeah.
There's a certain element that I almost want to say, I don't want to call it maybe shock, because like, it didn't feel completely real. Even though I knew it was real, it didn't feel completely real, because there's an element where it just didn't seem believable, but mm-hmm. it was obvious that it was real at the same time. But yeah, like I said, well, fine. You don't have to have anything to do with it.
Yeah.
I'm going to turn them in.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how I'm going to do it yet, but I'm going to do it. And, you know, if it ever gets back to me, I won't say anything about you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he was completely happy with it, but I think he also saw there wasn't shit he was going to do about it.
Yeah.
So I think I gave him the gun. I can't remember. Did I give him the gun? I might have just given him the gun.
Yeah.
But like, I was a felon. I didn't need to get caught with a gun anyhow, you know? So that's what I did. Like, he left later on in the day, and I decided that I was basically going to, you know, mail it in to the police department.
Mm-hmm.
Not mail by like putting a stamp on it, but mail by leaving it in an envelope in a mailbox with like a note on the outside of the envelope that made it obvious that this isn't something you want to like take down to your post office and mail. This is something you need to deliver, like hand deliver to the police department.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember I put it in like a little change purse and wrote a note on my computer. Said something like, I stole this from such and such an address, and I don't want anything to do with it, but please remove this animal from the street. And I put it in the envelope, and I think the envelope said, like, 911, deliver to police department. Mm-hmm. And I think I even wrote, like, graphic photos on it.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that to, like, really alert anybody who saw it in their mailbox.
So at this moment, Matthew Hahn has risked life in prison in order to save this young girl. And due to Hahn's prior criminal record and the 3 strikes law in California, turning over this memory card to land in the hands of the proper authorities effectively provides evidence not only of a sexual assault on a child, but also of a burglary committed by Matthew Hahn. He knew he was sealing his fate inside of that envelope and leaving it in a mailbox to be found and turned into the police. Yet, he did it anyway. Seemingly a petty thief, his sense of duty to protect a young girl he had never met drove him to sacrifice his life of crime and drugs, jeopardize his freedom, and prove that his moral compass has a true north.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Do you know who eventually turned it into the police?
I found out later that it was actually the mail person.
Oh, okay.
Because I think if I remember right, I put the flag up.
Yeah, okay.
I put the flag up, so like the person thought they were coming to pick up,
mm-hmm.
you know, like outgoing mail. But yeah, it was actually the mail person got it and took it to the police that day. So I remember I spent a couple of weeks, maybe a week. I don't remember how long. Like, there's like a local newspaper in that small town I was mm-hmm. in. like going down to Starbucks, like looking at the local newspaper, like what's in the local, you know, like reading the police blotter. Like I was already like always like reading the police blotter. I was kind of obsessed with like seeing like how many of my burglaries made the police blotter. Like it was just a thing.
Yeah.
So I was always like kind of like going and getting this like newspaper already, but like I was like really on it at that point. And I don't remember whether it was a week or two later, I read that this guy, Robbie Akins, had been arrested for child molestation or child rape or whatever the charges were. And so I felt relief there because it said anonymous tip, yada, yada, yada. I'm like, oh, they didn't link me up to it. And so like I kind of was able to let go of it at that point. You know, I just kind of went my merry way, you know, causing a ruckus in the neighborhood, you know. And so I was still using, and I was continuing to burglarize. And at some point, I was arrested for that. I'd sold something on eBay.
You were arrested for?
For burglaries.
For that one, though?
No.
Oh, okay.
Just for burglaries.
Oh, okay.
I
thought you were saying, like, maybe you sold some other contents from the safe.
No. I think I might have sold, like, the things that I stole from him the night, a couple nights earlier. Okay. I think I did sell those on eBay, but...
It's a whole business.
Yeah.
You got an eBay account.
I was fencing a lot of stolen property back then on eBay, and it wasn't quite like it. I don't think you could get away with it today. Back then, nobody registered anything on with their serial numbers. And, or most people didn't have things registered with their serial numbers. But clearly, some people did because that's how I ended up getting arrested.
Okay.
I had stolen something, sold it to someone in Ohio. It got traced back to me. And I get arrested in April of 2005.
So then how did they find out that you were the one that stole the safe?
So I had been on parole in this small town for a number of years kind of prior. And so I had a little bit of a, let's just say, amicable relationship with the police department to the extent that they knew who I was. I knew the officers that arrested me. And so they had arrested me for this. And when I was taken down to the station... there was basically a moment where they said, we'd like to have an off-the-record conversation with you. And so it was actually on my way from the substation in Los Gatos to the main jail that night that I told them off the record that, you know, I don't know if I'd said I'd actually stolen the safe or if I just told them the contents of the safe. Either way, whatever I told them, like, they knew that I was the person who had basically found the photos and turned them in. But it was off the record.
Yeah.
And so like there were, and they actually stuck to their, they stuck to their word on that. You know, like I know sometimes we're going to hear that, like, you know, the cops will say this is off the record and then they use it as something against you. It ended up not making its way to the official record.
Yeah.
So I think I read it in the grand jury testimony and I don't remember completely how I got that. I think somebody sent it to me while I was in the county jail, but I read later that when we had entered the property that he had left the cottage to go to the house to, I don't know, get a drink or something out of the kitchen. And that while he was in the kitchen, he had heard voices outside.
Okay.
So he had actually heard us there. And there was something about that that was kind of like creepy. I'm like, so like,
creepy.
I remember like the weird intuitive moment. I remember going like, maybe there was like,
so I think your intuition like, was right. Yeah.
At least in this instance again.
But I also think your intuition, I mean, I believe in, I mean, hopefully that, all things work out to benefit someone else. So to benefit this girl and this family to stop this, get some sort of closure, like maybe you were intuitive of like, I mean, you didn't know what you were going to find in there, but
I did not.
Yeah.
You know, like I am not much of a God man.
Yeah.
But I can say that there are elements of this that are
serendipitous.
Miraculous.
And miraculous.
Serendipitous,
and
whatever you want to call it.
And it also changed your life.
You know, it changed a number of people's lives.
Yeah.
So fairly dramatically. So yeah, like he knew it was stolen. He knew right away it was stolen because he probably watched us steal it. If I remember right, he even said that he thought the truck sounded like a Toyota, which he was right.
Yeah.
So like he knew the sound of a Toyota, which I thought was interesting. Anyways. And so he ended up calling the police and reporting the burglary. So it was actually a perfect setup for the police a number of days later because they just called him and said, hey, we may have found someone recovered or whatever it was from the burglary. Let's talk to you about it. Come on down to the station and claim it. Something like that. So he just like goes down there they're going to talk to him about the burglary, and they, I guess they chit-chatted him for a few minutes.
He probably thinks that the safe wasn't broken into, just like...
Maybe.
Yeah.
God, could you imagine being him going down to the police station to recover the... Yeah.
Oof.
Either way, like... but what they did is they took one of the photographs from the memory card, blew up his face,
mm-hmm.
and just, like, set it on the counter in front of him. And apparently he... mostly confessed
mm-hmm.
at that point.
Robbie Aitkins was an employee of the father's business whose daughter he molested. He had become close with the family, babysat their firstborn girl, and was named her godfather. The family trusted him, but he was a wolf in sheep's clothing. Now, this isn't to say that we couldn't trace a life of trauma back to Robbie and perhaps what caused him to be a monster to a little girl, but it wasn't a one-off occurrence. When police investigated, they found the little girl's dress stuffed in a bag in a motorcycle helmet, and then a computer forensic search was done on Robbie's computer and found thousands of pornographic images, including more than 100 that were identified as illegal child pornography.
And so, like, it was basically something that even though I was fighting my case, there's no official documentation saying that I was in any way related to the Aitkins case.
Mm-hmm.
So I was facing, as we discussed earlier with the three strikes
yeah.
law, when I was first arrested there,
mm-hmm.
I was only charged with 4 counts of possession of stolen property.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would have been 4 felonies. And so that would have been technically facing 100 years to life.
Jeez.
I knew I was going to be a 3 strike candidate,
mm-hmm.
obviously, but that doesn't mean the computer system was going to know that.
Yeah.
I figured that that wouldn't happen until I went to court the first time.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did is... I asked family to bail me out right away. So I bailed out of jail that night on a 3 strikes case, I think $10,000 bail or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had 2 weeks to think about it because my court date wasn't for, I think, let's see, that would have been April 8th, April 9th. My court date wasn't until April 22nd. So yeah, 2 weeks until I was going to have to show up in court and, you know, face life in prison. So that was an interesting couple of weeks.
Life, like, yeah, it's... That's a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I drank a lot during those 2 weeks. And, you know, I actually never did meth again after April 8th,
mm-hmm.
There 2005. So I got arrested that night and, like, I stopped doing meth. That might have been mostly because, not because I didn't want to, but because I was getting tailed everywhere by the cops.
Mm-hmm.
It's like they knew I'd bailed out. So, like, the local police department, they'd follow me down the street, like, in their car. I'd go into 7-Eleven. They'd park into the 7-Eleven parking lot. They'd follow me. They'd watch me get a Slurpee. It was, like, kind of intense. So I was just, like, drinking and trying to decide if I was going to run.
That's
basically what it came down to. Because being out on $10,000 bail or whatever it was, it might have been 20, but either way, significantly low bail
mm-hmm.
compared to what the amount of time I was facing. It made the idea of running pretty attractive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it's not like anybody was going to lose their retirement or something.
Yeah,
based upon me running. And so, like, I seriously considered it, but it just didn't end up... It's hard to describe. I guess I could tell the story, like, that morning. Like, so, like, I think it was a Friday morning, April 22nd. You know, I still kind of had, like, some skepticism about whether I would go to court or not. And, but there was just something in me that was just, I was a little tired,
mm-hmm.
you know, being a dope fiend's hard work. And I know it sounds kind of funny, but, like, what I mean is, like, it's taxing. It's emotionally taxing, running, lying, stealing,
mm-hmm.
lying to your family, hiding, like, just all the shame. Which was really kind of coming to the fore because I wasn't getting high on the meth anymore, which is, of course, why I was drinking so much. But there was just really no way of hiding it. And I remember I got high one last time. It was the morning going to court. I was just pot, but it did the trick. You know, I smoked a bowl, I swept the driveway, and I went to court. And, you know, like, I didn't bring anything with me. Like,
mm-hmm.
I knew they were going to take me in, you know? So, like, I didn't wear any jewelry. I didn't wear a belt. I didn't bring a wallet.
Mm-hmm.
I brought cash with me. And so, like, I went to the courtroom and they said, "Your Honor, this guy is a 3 strike candidate. He's currently facing 100 years to life." This is what the district attorney said. "He's
mm-hmm.
currently facing 100 years to life. We expect more charges to come. Clearly, he is a flight risk. So we want to remand him into custody." And I just stuck my hands out and they slapped cuffs on because there's really no question about it. And I remember they put me in the jury box. And then a bailiff would come over, and he basically, before they take me through the door to the jail portion of the courthouse and then kind of offer booking, they have to kind of register all your property, your personal property. And he's like, all right, like shoes, check, you know, pants, check, collared shirt, check, belt. I'm like, nope. He's like, jewelry? I'm like, nope. He's like, wallet? I'm like, nope. He's like, you have anything on you? I'm like, I have cash. He's like, how much money? I'm like, $300. And if I remember right, $300 was the maximum you could bring in without having to have it turned into a check and become part of your property. Like, I brought like the maximum cash I could bring in to have on my books in the jail. And I remember when I said the $300 cash, the sheriff just looked at me and he's like, you knew this was going to happen.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah. He's like, why did you come here? And I looked at him and I said kind of what I said earlier. I said, I just don't have it in me anymore. I just don't have it in me to fight.
Yeah.
And so like in some ways, like I feel like there is like an actual and metaphorical or spiritual or emotional like surrender that happened that day for me, because it was like there's a part of me that saw, I suppose, like going to jail as my way out, you know,
as your way out of addiction. And,
yeah. There's some part of me that just said, this is a way I can end it.
Yeah. And there is some part of this story though, too, where they kind of rallied around you in terms of the Aikens case.
Yeah.
Because that was
eventually.
Yeah.
That came later, you know? So that was, I got remanded into custody there in April of 2005. And over the course of the next few months, you know, they brought whatever it was, like 12 more felony charges against me. I think one of them was a first degree burglary. If we're going back to like my explanation of burglaries, one of them was a residential burglary. All the rest were like, I think second degree burglary, possession of stolen property, possession of methamphetamine, which was ironic because it was like literally, it was like just a baggie, an empty baggie, but they were still giving me possession for it. And of course, each one of those carried a penalty of 25 to life. Mm-hmm. So, you know, tally all that up and you get a potential for 400 to life. I mean, not that that's a whole lot different than 100 to life.
Yeah, I mean, you're gonna, you're in there anyways.
Life is life.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose 25 to life is different because, you know, like I was still young at the time, so like you got a shot at 50 type thing. But when you start getting into the hundreds, it's like which century, it doesn't really matter anymore. So that was a tough place to be, obviously. You know, like I was suicidal at the time. It was a really rough period in my life. They sometimes describe it as, you know, like when people say they have a near-death experience, their life flashes before their eyes.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't like have it flash because it was long and drawn and like slow and like torturous, but it was more like laying in my cell, like staring at the ceiling, just reviewing everything I'd ever done in my life up to that point. And like this is where the story ends. Like that's kind of, it was almost like the near-death experience, just very slow. And that's what it was like for, I don't know, maybe probably almost a year, maybe a little bit more than a year, because it wasn't until early on in 2006 that the district attorney that was prosecuting Robbie Aikens, now mind you, like at this point, like Robbie Aikens is facing I think 25 to life because the photographs were severe enough that they're not there wasn't any question about how bad it was. And so like he was facing a life sentence on a first offense. So that was pretty bad. But then of course I was facing like 400. So like I was facing 16 times the amount of time as him. This is how, you know, mandatory minimum sentences work. This is how the criminal justice system works when you give people time for prior offenses.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I just got a letter the other day from a friend of mine named Ryan that I did time with. And, you know, he got out of prison and he kind of was a similar story to me in the sense that, like, you know, he's this dope fiend that goes to stealing once he starts getting high. And, man, I just got a letter from him and he just got 23 years for burglary, you know. And I was like, he sent me his court paperwork so I could see how it worked. And he basically got 14 of those years is just for having priors itself. So like the burglary itself carried like 6 or 8 or whatever the heck it was, but then they gave him like 5 for this prior, 5 for that prior, 2 for this prior, and 2 for, it's like, so they stacked on like 14 years, not for crimes he committed, just for having the prior record. It's kind of remarkable if you think about it.
Yeah.
But that's the way it works. And ironically, like, and this would come a few months later, but like my lawyer ended up on the Glenn Beck show. I think Glenn Beck was like on Fox News at the time.
Yeah.
This is back in the day. And so, like, my lawyer ended up on, like, a show with Glenn Beck, like, discussing my case. And even Glenn Beck, like, the guy's a little crazy, right? Like, we all know that. But, like, this might be the only time he ever said anything, like, I agree with. Now, I didn't get to see the show. I just got to read the transcript because I don't exactly have Fox News in my cell, right? I only found out about it later. But Glenn Beck even said, like, you know, Han should be allowed to burglarize something, like, for every day the rest of his life and still do less time than Aiken.
Yeah.
And it's, like, the only thing he ever said that I agreed with.
Yeah.
Although I don't know if I actually agree with, like, stealing every day the rest of my life and still doing less time. But I think the point
I think the effect that it has on other humans is far different than it. People can get over something being stolen from them. I'm not sure that someone can really get over, like, a child, like, their innocence stolen from them.
Yeah. I get that. And it's like, I think
that's kind of the point.
And I don't want to downplay what I did, though, you know, because
I don't think you are.
I mean, I hurt, you know, actually, I hurt countless people, like, yeah. I'm almost anonymous people, to the extent that I can't put a face to the people I've hurt. I've hurt enough people. I've stolen from enough people. I don't know where I stole from, you know, because I'd had that off the record conversation with the police on the way to the jail. Mm-hmm. Like, whoever in the department or the district attorney's office, they knew I was associated with the burglary. Mm-hmm. Though nothing official, right? Mm-hmm. And so what ended up happening is that the district attorney and my lawyer came to visit sometime, the district attorney that was prosecuting Robbie Aikens came to visit me sometime in early 2006, so like maybe a little bit less than a year after getting arrested. And basically what was happening was that because the evidence had been stolen from Aitken's house and there was no like chain of possession between where it was stolen from and the police department, mm-hmm. there was no way of ruling out that the police hadn't actually gotten an anonymous tip and then engaged in the crime themselves, right? So like there's this concept called, like, I think it's called fruit of the poison tree.
Uh-huh.
So it's related to constitutional law. So basically a police officer can't engage in an illegal act to get evidence.
Oh, okay.
Right. And if they do engage in an illegal act in order to obtain evidence, then everything that follows from that illegal act can't be admissible in court. Right. So the argument I think that was being made by the Aitkins defense team was that we know the crime got committed,
mm-hmm.
and poof, it ends up with the police, like fruit of the poison tree. Like we know he called the burglary and he called it in that morning. This isn't like after the fact, like saying it was stolen. We know it was stolen, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So like basically what the district attorney wanted was somebody to establish the chain of possession. And there was only one person that could do that. And that was me. Now my lawyer told me that I shouldn't go on the record saying, quote, I stole the safe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was being a good lawyer by saying that because, if I said I stole the safe, then it was going to be impossible for me really to present a defense in my own trial.
Mm-hmm.
Because my defense ultimately was, if there is one, was I was only caught with stolen property. Mm-hmm. I never got caught stealing. So my defense was going to be like, why am I charged with burglary? I should just be charged with possession of stolen property and hope that a jury doesn't give me 25 to life for that.
Uh-huh.
That's like ultimately what I was hoping for. So if I actually went on the record, it could get used in my court. If I can't say like I wasn't actually stealing anything if there's a recording of me saying I stole a safe.
Yeah.
So obviously he told me not to say that. But when push came to shove, you know, like I sat down and the district attorney, you know, it's funny because like you think things work a certain way. And mm-hmm. I think she knew, she was used to people thinking things work a certain way like they do on TV. Because
mm-hmm.
she began the whole conversation with, this isn't like Law and Order. Like, I don't have the ability to give you a deal. Like, mm-hmm. I can't like offer you leniency. I can't offer you anything, mm-hmm. you know? This is your own free will.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to ask you questions. You can answer them. It's up to you, you know? Now, I'm sure there are backroom deals that happen in places, but it sure is, I guess it wasn't happening for me,
yeah.
At least not then.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
So I did avoid saying the words, I stole the safe. Mm-hmm. But at some point, like, I think she got a little frustrated with my avoiding saying I stole the safe. And she kind of like turned the tape off and said, yeah, we need to establish chain of possession. We need you to basically, mm-hmm. we need nobody else to have possessed this between when it got stolen and when the police got it. Mm-hmm. And I knew what she was saying. So when she turned it back on, she basically said, did anybody else ever possess the safe?
And how were you feeling in that moment of like, were you like, shit, if I say this?
I think it was my second surrender.
Yeah.
Like the first surrender was like going to the court that morning. The second mm-hmm. surrender for me was like, I'm just going to say that nobody else ever had the safe except me. Mm-hmm. And there was a certain element of relief because that's what I said. I said, nobody. I'm the only person that had the safe. And there was a certain sense of relief, I remember, that mm-hmm. washed over me because, like, I wasn't in control anymore. Mm-hmm. Not that I was in control before, but, like, I can convince, I can, like, there's, like, yeah. you know, like, I could be deluded enough to think that I'm in control
yeah,
somehow.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, after that, like, there was no doubt. Like, I was no longer in the driver's seat. This yeah. was up to juries and judges and eventually mm-hmm. public opinion. Yeah. Like, really what it came down to.
And so... The part where yeah like the public basically or the newspaper sort of rallied around you to reduce the sentence, right?
Yeah, well, the newspaper didn't actually rally; they just got the people rallied.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
I guess that's what I mean. Yeah.
They certainly presented the story in a very like good light, right? Because mm-hmm. That could have gone any number of ways. We all know yeah. how the media can be. Like, they decided not to portray me as prolific as maybe I was, but they portrayed me in a good light. And ultimately yeah. what ended up happening is there's people that I didn't know that, you know, started like a petition, and there were people who were actually, you know, calling the district attorney's office and saying like, you need to give this guy leniency. Mm-hmm. And then there was a couple of more articles that came out in like editorial sections. Mm-hmm. And like I said, stuff was happening on Glenn Beck, and there was like, it got out a little bit. Mm-hmm. There was actually one point where like I was listening to a radio show in my cell, mm-hmm. in my cell block, listening to them have a conversation about me, about whether I should get life in prison, and then they were taking callers.
Oh right? My god. Oh, that is so surreal.
So like they're taking callers on this show, and I'm like listening to this. Now, mind you, everybody in the whole cell block is listening to the same damn thing, right? So like here's a cell block, there's like 40 cells in this little cell block.
You're like
and everybody's listening.
Is everyone looking at me right
like,
now?
Like, you know, like we got these little headphones, you know, like everybody's listening. So it's funny because like everybody's alone and listening to the same thing simultaneously. And it's so funny because they're like, you know, like, we're going to take callers now. And so, like, he starts taking callers, and one person called in and said, give him life, but give him an extra pillow, you know, like, and someone's like, extra conjugal visits, you know, like, this is the type of shit they were saying, you know?
Oh, my God.
Nobody called in to say, like, you know, like, give the guy a break, other than the pillow person.
Yeah.
And, but then, like, one person called in, and she said, you could tell she was like in traffic or something. You could hear yeah. like cars going by. I remember hearing it. Like, and she said, you know, like, I actually, when I called, I like had sympathy for him. But now that I think about it, and then she goes, Han should be gone. And the next thing you know, like out through the cell block, you're hearing this yell, like, Han should be gone. Like everybody.
Do they know that you're in there? Like, do they know
yes,
that's
Yes, they
you?
All know it's me.
Oh my God.
Because
what
it's,
a
we
weird...
get the newspaper delivered to us. So they're seeing me on the front page of the newspaper. So like the cell block is like, Han should be gone. You know, like I go and I get, so this happens for like weeks. I go and I get my chow, like I pick up my tray, Han should be gone. Cop walks by the cell, Han should be gone. Like everybody's fucking saying it like everywhere, Han should be gone. It was totally playful. It wasn't
no,
actually.
They were just joking.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah, yeah.
It
was
yeah,
totally
yeah.
playful, but it was like it took a few weeks for that one to die down, you know. But
I just can't even imagine. Like I just feel very vulnerable about it. Like I can't even imagine. Like you're sitting in a freaking cell block, you're hearing yourself on the radio, and everyone's like reacting to it. Like
yeah, it was kind of surreal.
I'd have a panic attack. I would probably curl up in a ball and have a panic attack.
Well, there was a certain element of fear. There's definitely a certain element of fear associated with it because, you know, I know we haven't talked about like my prison experience that much today, but
yeah, we can go into that. Yeah,
you know, there's like a prison politic, you know, mm-hmm. about, you know, snitching or sex offender and all this mm-hmm. other stuff. And people who aren't familiar, like if someone goes to prison and they're in the general population, you know, like there's basically only a handful of things that you don't want to be. And one of those is a snitch, and one of those is a sex offender, and there's a few other things. But mm-hmm. like, I wasn't a sex offender, but I was worried that someone would get still be bent out of shape about me having turned the guy in.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so, like, I started to, like, kind of get this fear about, like, oh, shit, like, when I go to prison, like, are people going to try to hold me accountable for having done the right thing, but still having told?
Yeah. It's almost like a double-edged sword of, like, it's probably, like, the sex offenders in prison don't like you because you turn, and then also you are labeled as a snitch.
But I would never have been in the prison with the sex offenders because they're under protective custody.
Oh, okay, okay, okay.
But that's actually interesting you mentioned that, because I got visited, excuse me, I got visited shortly after the article came out in the newspaper by mm-hmm. like the classification staff in the county jail.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember they pulled me out of my cell. It was like 3 a.m. Like, they worked weird hours or whatever. But he brought me in and he says, so, like, I'm with classification and I want to know if you would like to go to protective custody. I'm like, why? Why do I need to go to protective custody? He's like, well, you know, you're getting media attention. And, mm-hmm. you know, like, your attention is specifically for turning in another person. You know, I need to warn you that you should probably fear for your life, you know, and that I should provide you, I have to offer protective custody to you. And, of course, that wasn't in the plan. So I yeah. said, you know, like, it, there's a certain element of, like, of course I'm scared, right?
Yeah.
I'm human. I'm scared. But at the same time, there's bravado and there's jail. And I remember I said to him, I said, if they got a problem, they can come talk to me about it.
Wow.
Because there's a part of me that, like, felt like this was the thing that was going to, that was, it was saving me.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's going to sound a little crazy, but I felt like if this was the thing that was going to save me, it wasn't the thing that was going to get me killed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's just something in my head that was like,
I think you're also kind of believing in a higher power. Like,
I know,
I don't
like,
know
and
what
like,
you're,
I know, like, but like, there's something that was happening that was just like, there was a trajectory here that mm-hmm. made me feel like,
yeah,
I just don't think that's how it's going to go down,
yeah.
you know, but if it does, it does, you know, like, but like, I had like this great sense of resignation and letting go though
yeah.
at that period of time in my life. And so like all that went down, the protective
yeah.
custody, the media attention, and eventually mm-hmm. they decided to offer me a plea bargain, which I took. So I ended up pleading guilty to 14 years, 4 months.
And part of it was for stealing the safe too.
No, I was never actually charged with that.
They gave you some sort of leniency for that, right? Or no?
They just never charged me with it.
Okay.
But, like, the only evidence they would have had was me admitting to, you know, being involved with it, because I don't think they ever caught me with any stolen property
yeah.
from the burglary anyhow. They had plenty of other evidence.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like, I've been doing this for years.
Well, it's not that. It's just, look, they don't actually care what they convict you of usually.
Yeah.
In fact, like, they had me charged with the possession of methamphetamine. Remember I told you about
mm-hmm.
that? Well, in California, if you're convicted of a felony drug charge, you have to actually, when you get out, register
mm-hmm.
as a drug offender. I don't know if you know that. It's like you're almost like a sex offender, but you have to register as a drug offender. So if I like live in point A and I move to city B, then I have to go to that police department, tell them I'm a dope fiend and I live here. And then if I move to the city next over, then I have to go to that police department.
But it's not like a list that the public can like look
Not
up.
That sort of, but it's like
yeah,
registration.
Yeah.
I just didn't like the idea of it. So I remember
yeah.
when I took the plea bargain, I got to court, they're like, they were reading off the charges and they got the meth one.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at my lawyer and said, I ain't pleading that one. And he's like, why? Why aren't you pleading to that one? I said, well, I don't want to register as a drug offender.
Yeah.
Plus, of all the charges, it's the one bullshit one.
Yeah.
Like, he's like, let me talk to him. And they said, well, they want to give you 16 months for something. I said, tell them to give me another burglary charge.
Yeah.
He leaves and he comes back. He's like, all right, secondary burglary, all right? I'm like, yeah, secondary
yeah.
burglary is fine. So they just slapped it. So they took off the meth charge, slapped on a burg charge. And so I just took another burg charge.
Because you didn't want to spend the rest of your life having to be
I don't know if it's the rest
hey,
of your life
for
10
up?
Years or something
yeah,
like
but
that. But I just did. It just seemed like,
yeah.
just give me a burglary charge. I already got him on there. Give me another one.
Well,
most people don't think that way, but like that's the position I was in at the time. So
yeah.
we just substituted charges. But that's what happens in the criminal justice system.
Well, so what is what happened later? Like, so you got sober in prison. You
Yeah, the last time I got
I
loaded was...
I
want
to hear about your life from there to now.
Okay.
Because it is, I mean, I'm sitting in your beautiful home and you know, a nice area. Like, you're
it's
doing
right
it.
Here. It's okay.
It's
We're
very
right.
nice. I live in a freaking apartment. Anytime I'm in a home, I'm like, oh, what is a home like? It's very nice.
If you knew the problems we had with the place we live in right now, you wouldn't be saying that. Well, still, but anyways, like that's a completely different conversation.
And but you're sober. You're like
so. No, life is great. Like yeah. But it's been almost 15 years since the period, or 14 years since the period of time we're talking mm-hmm. about. So, by the way, Aiken ended up getting 30 years.
And is he still in?
He's still in.
All right.
I think I looked him up recently, and I think he's technically like. Believe it or not, eligible for parole. And
I don't think I really like that, but okay. Do they do anything in prison to like help reform the?
I have no idea. I've never been on one of those yards. I don't want to be on one of those yards.
Yeah, like
one would hope that there's rehabilitation programs there.
Yeah.
But like I said, I wouldn't be confident in it. I would hope something like that's there. But either way, he got 30 years, and the only reason he got 30. And not life, because that was a plea bargain.
Mm-hmm.
They gave him a plea bargain. But the reason he got 30 is because I guess the grand jury thing was so traumatic for the family that the district attorney, they basically asked the district attorney they didn't want to go through a trial. Mm-hmm. Like it was too much. And so they said, if you can offer him like a really long sentence, then mm-hmm. we're okay with that. And so they offered him 30 and he took it.
Okay, so you're in prison now for how long?
So my sentence was 14 years,
mm-hmm.
4 months, and I was going to have to do basically 7 of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I ended up serving was about 7. Obviously I'd been up in the county jail up till that point, but after taking the plea bargain and getting sentenced, you know, like I was shipped off to prison. That was kind of an interesting moment unto itself because like, even though I wasn't going to tell anybody when I got to prison, you know, about my story, because I was kind of worried about how that would get taken. When I was like called to go to prison,
mm-hmm.
like the entire like cell block that I was in, they were all out for program playing cards and stuff like that. I shit you not, it's kind of like weird. Like they like all stood up and like clapped on my way out. It was actually like a really weird experience. Like one of like the kind of like the shot callers for one of the gangs in there, actually it was kind of sweet. Like it was weird, but it was sweet. He like gave me a card with like a weird Catholic painting of like a guardian angel on it.
That's so sweet. He said,
this is from the homies to you. Like that's, it was kind of like this weird, it was like a weird like send off because like once I got on that bus, I wasn't telling anybody what had happened, but I don't know, that kind of felt good when that happened.
And that was from going to, from
county jail to prison.
Okay, got it.
So it was kind of weird, like, having people, like, honor you on your way out.
Yeah.
It was kind of a strange experience. And I'm sure the guards were like, why are they all clapping for this guy?
That's very, it's strange because, yeah, but it's also kind of a nice look into humanity, too, that where, like, this guy, like, the gang member guy that you're talking about, like, we could all be like, oh, he's probably just fucked up, crazy, whatever. It's like everyone has like a soul, and for the most part, and
well, I think in this case, a lot of them have kids.
Yeah, it's
probably really what it comes down to.
Yeah,
identification there.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I was shipped off to prison, and I, you know, I did a brief, you know, classification period at Tracy, which is a prison in Tracy.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually called the prison's called DVI, but it's in Tracy,
mm-hmm.
And that's just basically where they figure out based upon who you are, how long you've done, where they need to send you.
Yeah.
And so then I ended up at Old Folsom. So that's...
Like the Folsom prison?
Like Folsom, like where Johnny Cash did the famous album.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if he recorded there twice, but he certainly played there twice.
Yeah.
And in fact, like I used to eat chow in the same chow hall every morning that Johnny Cash like did his concert.
Why do they call it chow? Just because it's just eating?
I don't know.
Okay, like, just curious.
Chow, like the word for food?
Yeah, or just eat food.
It might be a military thing. Maybe it comes from
maybe
the military.
Maybe that is,
I don't know,
it is.
Like, because they call it chow time.
Yeah.
Chow hall.
That might be what it is.
Eating
yeah.
chow.
I think it is a military term.
You know, you're not the first person to give me shit for using that term, because sometimes like I'll just say, like, it's chow time, and I'm just talking about dinner. You know what I mean? So, but, you know, you take man out of prison, you can't take all the prison out of man.
Exactly. Like, you have different terms for things
I do. Like, feeding the warden.
What does that
means taking a dump?
What?
Feeding the warden.
That's so,
I mean, I thought you, like, thought you want to know something.
No,
like,
yeah, no,
it's like that, important terminology, right?
That's that. No, I'd love, this is cool inside scoop.
Yeah. So anyways, like, I was at Folsom for a couple of years.
I'm also, hold on, I'm also like picturing you like in like just a random setting with people being like, I gotta go feed the ward, and they're like, what the fuck is he talking about? Like outside.
Well, you do now. Often, like when you live in a cell, you usually got to tell your cellie when you're getting ready to drop a deuce.
Yeah, but I'm.
I mean, think about
I'm
it.
I'm
right?
saying like, outside of prison.
Oh yeah,
if
outside
you ever
of prison.
Use that phrase, people would be like, what is the fuck is he talking about?
No, but sometimes I'll use it just because I know nobody knows what the hell I'm yeah. talking about. I say I gotta go feed the warden, and be like,
they're like, what?
All right.
Okay. Yeah. Well.
And I walk off.
They're like. They're like, we're all uncomfortable now.
Sometimes
we don't understand.
They'll say, feed yeah. the warden. It's terrible. Totally disgusting. But yeah, no, like when you live in a cell with somebody, mm-hmm. like sometimes you're like, let's say your cellie. I mean, think about it, your cell. It's like.
So your toilet is in the.
Yeah, like, okay, so like I, nobody can see me demonstrate this, but I can tell them like the cell wide is if I hold my elbow out and then my left hand extended.
How many feet would you say that is?
That's how wide a cell is. So Greg, it's like whatever, 3.5, 4 feet. 4 feet, 5 feet?
5 feet.
That's how wide, and there's two people living in there?
Right, and then they're like maybe 9 or 10 feet long. Two bunks, there's a toilet, there's shelving, and all that other stuff in there. So like let's say your cellie is on the lower bunk, right? He's sitting on his lower bunk, and he's eating dinner. Chow, but he's eating dinner, right?
Yeah.
The toilet's right here.
Oh my God.
Right? So like if I have to like go to the bathroom, there's got to be an announcement. Hey, boy, you know, I gotta drop one.
No,
like, can you wait till I stop eating or like whatever, you know, like no, it's an emergency. So like he needs to like get down to the end of the cell or usually like put a cover on his food because like just what he'll do. And he'll wait till I finish my thing because got to drop the sheet so that he doesn't have to watch me do it.
I can't imagine the anxiety of that. Like that.
When it comes to like pooping.
Yeah.
like prison changed me. When I first met my wife, Noelle, mm-hmm. We hadn't been dating like more than a week mm-hmm. or two. And like I remember I'm at her apartment and yeah. I gotta go to the bathroom. I don't close the door. You know, I'm just in there, I'm taking a dump. Like she's like, is he pooping right now with the door open? I'm like, I'm just not used to having closed spaces. Because I met her like 3 months after getting out, you know?
Oh wow.
So like I was like still kind of unwinding a little bit.
Yeah.
But no, this is like normal. Like, and it's funny because like if you think about it, like you have the intimate stuff like that, like you're in a cell with somebody.
Yeah.
Right? But then there's like the out in the open stuff. Like, let's say you go to yard.
Mm-hmm.
I go to yard. It's not like you can go back to your cell to go to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
You're on the yard. You're stuck there for whatever, 2 hours, 3 hours, whatever it is. You got to bring your roll of toilet paper with
this
you.
This is
hold on. You bring
horrific.
Your roll of toilet. You got to bring a roll of toilet paper with you everywhere you go. I still do that. Like, I have rolls of toilet paper in the back of my car because you never know when you're going to need it. You know, like,
that's very
I carry
true.
It with me, but it's actually because of prison. Just like in prison, I always carry like a spoon with me. Right? You need a spoon, you need a fork, you need toilet paper wherever you go. And a cup, plastic cup.
Well,
you never know.
It's like teaching you, to, like, maybe it taught you just survival mechanism stuff.
Like, sure, like basic, like bring everything with
yeah,
you.
Yeah, so
like,
you're not just uncomfortable in any situation.
Yeah. But back to the yard thing. So, like, you bring your toilet paper with you to the yard, but you just got to imagine, like, you got 20 stainless steel toilets in a row, completely out in the open, right? Like, there's no, like, little stall doors between them. Like, there's no, like, you know, like pull a curtain. Like if you got to go, you're pooping in front of 500 people.
Oh my God.
Like that's just how it is. Right. Oh and God. Like, so you get used to this. Like, so like, there'll be like a holding cell to go to medical, right? Like, so yeah. You got to go to the doctor. There's a toilet in the holding cell to go to medical. You're in there with 20 other guys. You got to go. You got to go. So like this is where like certain etiquette comes in.
Yeah.
Right. Like that becomes important. So like courtesy flushing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if we don't really have courtesy flushing out here in the same way. Like usually the courtesy flushing on the streets is like say someone you know is in the shower and you got to go to the bathroom and you know if you flush it, it's going to get really hot or get yeah. really cold. You're like, I'm going to flush the toilet. Watch it. You know, like that's like the idea. That's the same idea. But in prison, it's different. It's both that. Not so often because you're not usually pooping next to where you're showering. Your pooping is in the cell. The showering is like somewhere else. That's also a public affair as well.
Yeah.
But like more like – you're trying to spare the person next to you from having to smell.
Yeah.
Or hear yourself, you pooping. We all know we make noises, right? Nobody wants to hear us make noises.
Yeah.
So flushing in prison actually becomes like an affair where you're synchronizing it with
any sound you're making.
So it's kind of like, so nobody has to hear it. And that the other idea is like it's supposed to suck the smell down with it because prison toilets are basically like really high powered Dysons, right?
Yeah.
They're like they really like blow. Air.
Oh, well, that really helps with the sound thing, though.
Right, so the sound and the odor aspect. So the idea is like, that's prison etiquette, right?
Yeah.
So I got a story for you. Like, it's really funny. Like, this isn't when I was in Folsom. This is when I get to fire camp. which we can talk about in a bit. But like, I'm in fire camp, so it's like a more minimum security camp. Like, there's no walls. There's nothing like that. And like, the water in that camp is fed off, like, this is actually in Santa Clarita, California. Mm-hmm. So there's like a water tank up on a hill that feeds like a percolation pond that then gets cycled into, it's where how the toilets run. Mm-hmm. For whatever reason, the water source supply had gotten cut off from the water tank up on the mountain. So we had no running water. We got like 90 guys sharing like 8 toilets. Everybody poops at the same time because they're all going to work at 7:30.
Yeah.
So we all go to chow. It's like 6:30. We go to chow. They drink their coffee. Everybody has to. This is basically like simultaneous, like doing your business because you're getting ready to go to work. So like everybody, like there's a line.
Well, as long as everyone's doing it at the same time, though, then it's not that awkward.
Well, no, everybody's doing it at the same time. But when the water's out, you don't have the ability to like flush.
Yeah.
So like, this is like this really odd, so like awkward social moment in prison. Like, because like, what do we do? What do we do? So what do you think somebody did? First of all, like, you have to imagine that we have these buckets. We have these 5-gallon buckets.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a chain of people like taking 5-gallon buckets down to the percolation pond, bringing water up back and forth to the bathroom to give to people on the toilet so they can pour the water into the toilet to flush. Because, you know, like toilets are automatic like that. So that's all happening. Imagine this chain of people with 5-gallon buckets from a percolation pond up to the bathroom just so we can flush the toilets. But what you have to also imagine is every time somebody's getting ready to drop one, they're screaming. So they're like, you know, like they don't want anybody to hear it. And we're so used to not having people hear it. So it's like someone's on the toilet and it's like, ah! And then someone's on the toilet, ah! Like everybody's screaming. It's like this really, really bad kind of like choir of like people like singing while they shit because nobody, they don't want anybody to hear the sounds they're making. Like, and like, this is something I think that's only like possible in prison, right? Like,
yeah,
we go to the bathroom publicly. And like, yeah, I don't like it when I make a sound if there's somebody next to me. But like, if you have to, you let it go. But you would never hear me singing it.
Well, you're
like
not,
really loud while
well,
I
you're
did
making
it.
But you guys are out in the yacht. Like, this is
in this particular instance with the singing. Like, this is like actually in a closed room, maybe as big as this room with like.
But are there partitions?
No, there's no partitions.
Are they just trying to publicly shame you in prison?
There's no,
Jesus.
Well, I mean, this is prison. There's no privacy.
Yeah.
Like, even when we're in our cell and
I
talk about...
Oh, I guess that's true. They just don't want to know what you're doing, like, in the... Yeah.
Yeah, like, even when we're in our cell and we're, like, when I said we'd have to, like, drop the sheet, like, technically, that's illegal.
Yeah.
Technically, most cops don't enforce it because they don't want to watch you doing it anymore than you want them to see you doing it. But technically speaking, like, covering any part of the cell with a sheet is against the rule.
Yeah.
Right? So a lot of the time, just to keep cops out of your cell, you'll roll your cover sheets up and kind of like stuff them underneath like the mattress, and then you just roll them down when you need them.
Yeah.
But yeah, like kind of like there's like weird like
that's not,
I mean, showering's the same way. It's like totally out in the open. Other weird like cultural thing, I mean, you, every time you go to work on the way back, you got to get stripped out. You know, so you go to work or you go to a visit, same way. Visit is like stripped out on the way into the visit, stripped out on the way out of the visit, but going to work is the same way. They want to make sure you're not like stealing tools or knives or whatever they think you're shoving up your prison wallet. And like, and you know, like, so like you just get used to getting stripped search. You get used to like kind of those dehumanizing things. You get used to like all this, like, for lack of a better word, the things that we hide from people, where you become really accustomed to sharing with people. To the extent that they just don't bother you anymore.
Yeah.
And so, like, I had to learn to, like, get re-bothered by this stuff when I got out. Like, I had to learn to, like, oh, there's boundaries around this stuff.
Yeah. Like, yeah, this is different.
Like,
than...
I should do the courtesy of closing the door to the bathroom when I do this.
Yeah. But you spent so much time, like, that your brain probably changes from, like,
caring.
That's what... Yeah.
Well, you don't want to feel traumatized every time you go to a visit.
Yeah.
You don't want to feel completely embarrassed and demeaned and humiliated every time you go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
So you learn to adapt to it. It becomes normalized for you, you know?
You entered a drug rehabilitation program in prison, right?
I did not.
No, you did not. I thought they had those sort of things there.
They did, but I didn't do... I mean, I think I participated in some while I was in the county jail briefly, but it was more just a way of passing my time. Like, it was like I was interested in it, but like what I would actually started doing was just like, you know, 12-step stuff, like meditation groups, things like that. Basically stuff where like free people, free as in like, you know, free staff, people from the free world would come in like as volunteers.
I'm such a moron and not, and I was like, oh, the brand Free People? I love that clothing brand.
It is a brand, isn't it? So like, no, like... free people would come in and, like, you know, teach meditation. They'd run groups and mm-hmm. things like that for you. And like, so like I was doing stuff like that. So taking advantage of like volunteer programs. And then, you know, during the day, like I worked in a welding shop. I worked as a landscaper, and eventually like,
do they pay you when you work in prison?
Yes. Well, the ones behind the walls are very, it's minimal.
Yeah.
I think when I was a landscaper, I made 7 cents an hour, 6 cents an hour, something like that. And then I owed 50% restitution, and you worked a 6.5 hour day, so I get like 36 cents, and then I get taxed like 60% of it, so I'd make like,
wow, they really punish you. Okay.
So I made like 11 cents a day. So like every other day I could get a top ramen noodle, which were 20 cents at the canteen. So I could get top ramen that way. Granted, like I actually had family who was like super supportive and loving and caring, yeah. and like sent me money periodically to basically make it so I didn't starve to death, because they don't exactly feed you well
mm-hmm.
in prison. I mean, I have the type of metabolism where if I don't constantly eat, like I'm starting to get lightheaded, like I'm hypoglycemic or something.
Yeah.
But the point is like that's
this one right here. Yeah.
Like that's why, like I call them fruit fits sometimes, like at night, like I'll just need calories somehow.
Yeah.
Like I don't care what it is. Like give me fruit juice, give me something.
I'm jealous. I have no metabolism. So
whatsoever.
Yeah.
So you don't have to eat.
I don't have a thyroid gland.
Oh, wonderful. But yeah, like, then I got, but eventually, like, after I was left Folsom, after I left Jamestown, like, I was in, like, kind of, like, the high security prison for a number of years, and then mm-hmm. I went to the fire camp, and they pay you better there.
Mm-hmm.
And for those who don't know, like, a fire camp is where California prisoners go to basically fight wildfires. And so I spent the last 3 years in prison, like, in a fire camp. In Santa Clarita, that's where the fantastic.
So, were you always? You never were back in the prison. You were actually like at a.
Yeah. Once I left for fire camp, mm-hmm. I was not behind a prison wall ever again. Except I think on one occasion I had to go to medical, and there's no medical facility, so they mm-hmm. drive you back to the closest prison.
Yeah.
Take you to medical, and they drive you back. But
that's pretty great that you didn't. Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of criticism of fire camps these days. You know, we got all the wildfires and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. They get a lot of criticism because even though they're the highest paid jobs for prisoners in the state of California, they're still underpaid. And so mm-hmm. there's a lot of discussion about like prison slavery and things mm-hmm. like that. I'm not sure I can really completely agree with that, but that's a totally different like mm-hmm. kind of political conversation. But for me, like it was like a super awesome, like fulfilling experience.
Yeah.
I was out in nature. I went hiking every morning. Like, I was doing something that was, like, I think beneficial for the community, for mm-hmm. It just felt like a worthwhile thing. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I remember we went up to Santa Barbara and we fought the Hesacita fire in Santa Barbara in 2009. And it was my first big fire I fought. And, like, we were actually fighting fires in, like, the neighborhoods where, like, fire was coming down into, like, people's houses. And some of the houses were burning down. And there was this one house I remember that was where the deck had burned. Mm-hmm. It was on fire. And so, like, if we let it be, then the deck would have lit the house on fire. So we took our chainsaws and we cut the deck off the house.
Ooh, smart.
So we cut the deck off the house and moved it away. And I always just, like, thought, like, these people, like, they're going to drive in their neighborhood. There's, like, house burned down. And they, like, see their house. They're like, holy cow, our house is still here. And imagine they, like, they go in, they look through their living room, but our deck is gone. But they're like, they see how close it got.
Yeah.
You know? And they never know that it was prisoners that did it. And I'll never forget like driving out of like Santa Barbara after we fought that fire, and there's like people on the side of the road, and there's like these thank you signs, and it's just thank you firefighters. Mm-hmm. It's not like thank you prisoners specifically, but it just felt good, you know, being where I was in mm-hmm. life to like feel like included in that.
Yeah.
However small it was, you know, yeah. like, there's a certain element. I mean, it's like really easy to assimilate. Like, you go everywhere you go, it says CDCR prisoner.
Mm-hmm.
Your pants says CDR. It's everything, every time you look in the mirror, mm-hmm. every time you talk to a guard, I'm reminded of what I am.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a prisoner. And, like, there's a certain element of, like, you just really start to assimilate that, you know?
Yeah.
And so to do that firefighter thing was awesome.
It gave you, like, a purpose of something different that you could
it
do.
It felt like you were a prisoner and a firefighter.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Like,
yeah.
There's this element of, like...
Yeah.
And I'm fighting fires.
Yeah.
And there's people thanking me. And there's people appreciating me who would otherwise have not appreciated
yeah.
me. And so in that sense, it's like a really awesome,
yeah.
awesome program. Not to mention visiting is like super cool there.
That's cool.
Like your family brings like a picnic basket and you barbecue. And so it's not like a prison visit behind glass. Like it's a great place
almost,
to be.
It's like close to real life-ish.
Well,
not
I wouldn't
really.
Go so
okay.
that far. It's not quite real
yeah,
life.
Yeah.
Look, as far as the best way to characterize it, it's the most humane place to live in the entire prison system.
Mm-hmm.
So like, yeah, I think most people, if they live in prison, if they had the opportunity, would love to go there.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people aren't eligible because I think violent people with violent crime convictions can't go and things like that. But for those who do go, I think they appreciate it a lot.
Yeah. So, okay, so.
And that's where I paroled from.
Yeah, and then you, so just like describe your life now. Like you got your, you've been sober how many years now?
Oh man, it's funny you start not keeping as much track as time goes on. I think what is it, 2019? So it's been, I guess I'm coming up on 15 years.
Yeah, and no other arrests, and
more arrests.
Yeah, and you have a great job. You got married.
I got out, and obviously I was on parole for a couple of years, but somehow I managed to commute and go to Berkeley from mm-hmm. the South Bay while I was on parole. I actually had a parole agent who worked with me
mm-hmm.
And made that possible, all because of college I did when I was in prison. And then I actually had a hell of a time trying to find work after graduating from college, even though, you know, it was a great university and what have you. I just, mm-hmm. The felonies, they make it tough.
Yeah.
They make it tough. And it's my own fault as far as, you know, what I did. But, you know, they are forever. And so, like, there is just a lot of places that I had a really difficult time, even though I was qualified.
Mm-hmm.
Had a difficult time finding work. And so eventually I got into the trades and became a union electrician. And I make great pay. And I really haven't looked back since. You know, like, it's like the trade gives me the ability to do all that other fun stuff I like to do, which mm-hmm. is like photography or traveling the world. And mm-hmm. We're getting ready to, you know, buy a house here in the next couple of months. So things that I really wouldn't have imagined, you know, were possible like 10 years ago. I mean, mm-hmm. 10 years ago, I moved from basically from prison to mm-hmm. fire camp, you know. And if you'd told me like 10 years from now, you're going to be married, you're going to be buying a house, you're going to be having traveled all over Asia and like stayed in monasteries as like a monk and like
so cool.
like doing all this like crazy stuff, just like it's graduated from Berkeley, like all that stuff, like I just never would have thought it was possible.
I think that's like a good, like kind of like a good lesson for like any of my listeners or anyone, like you never know what good things can happen, you know, like
you never know what good things are happening. And I think like if there's another thing like to take away from me thinking about my own life in like mm-hmm. a narrative fashion like that, is like you never know what the bad things that happen are going to transform themselves into.
Yeah.
Like
I think that's
prison sucks.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't want to trade that path for anything.
Yeah.
You know, like you know, like it's damaged me in a little way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I'm still, you know, like I had to go to therapy for a couple of years because mm-hmm. of, you know, survival strategies.
I can imagine that would be very damaging. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and I really didn't want to accept that for a long time. Yeah. I really didn't want to accept the fact that being put in a cage would be traumatic, because there's an element of like, I put myself up here, I need to pull myself up by my bootstraps type attitude. But it took me a couple of years to realize like that may be the case, but there's still work to be done. And so like, I like the whole slogan. Some things might not be my fault, but it's still my responsibility. And so mm-hmm. like, I wouldn't want to change anything other than maybe the amount of harm I've caused others.
Yeah.
You know, along the way.
Yeah. Well, you're an incredibly interesting, intelligent, and kind person. I really like you, and you've been so wonderful to us coming here. And yeah, I thank you so much for doing the podcast. And
absolutely, it's been fun.
Tell everyone where they can, like your website and your, you know, because you do your writing on there.
Yeah, I've got a blog that you can read some of my stories, some of the ones we talked about today, mm-hmm. and some that we didn't talk about today. The website is Han Scratch,
mm-hmm.
so that's my last name, HAHN Scratch, mm-hmm. SCRATCH, and that's the same thing for my social media, so Instagram, Twitter, Han Scratch at Han Scratch. I've been posting a ton lately, though I'm sure I'll post this podcast mostly because I'm in the process of just finally putting the book together. And so I'm trying not to cheat the book by putting stuff on the website, but there's lots of stories that are up, maybe 15 or 20 stories.
When do you think your book will come out? Or
I don't know when it'll come out, but my personal deadline is Christmas next year. So,
okay. God, that's going to be a good read.
It's hard to do when you're working full time and going to school full time and all this other stuff, as I've been trying to get it done, but it's a commitment I've set for myself here.
Yeah. Well, congratulations.
Congratulate me when it's done.
All right. Fair enough. Well, thank you for doing this.
Hey, you're welcome.